Hello, how are you? Welcome to episode number 193 of the AppLove Podcast. I'm your host, Simon Head. Today's podcast is brought to you in part by BetterHelp.com. You can get affordable private online counseling anytime, anywhere. Talk with a licensed professional therapist online. Get your free 7-day trial with the code word AppLove when you go to BetterHelp.com/AppLove. Go there. I'd like to thank all the Amazon shoppers for shopping on Amazon. You too can support the show by going to appalock.ca/Amazon or appalock.ca/USAmazon. You can do the old-fashioned way as well by going to appalock.ca and click on those banners located on the right side. Locate your country, whether you're from Canada, the USA, or the UK. Bookmark all those links, and every time you shop on Amazon, use those links to shop and support the show, and it costs you no extra money. If you want to help the show out on a monthly basis, go to patreon.com/AppLog. patreon.com/AppLog. Pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with my hosting and gas fees, and you can cancel at any time. If you want to buy a t-shirt, buy some music, go to applog.ca/shop. If you're into iTunes, go to iTunes. You can find the show there. Rate, review, subscribe. Give it 5 stars, please. Like the show on Facebook by going to facebook.com/applogpod. Follow me on Twitter at simonhead666. Today on the show, I have Mr. Alistair Hepburn, who is a production manager. He is a person who works in art and with industry and art. He is an interesting fella. I met him a little over 10 years ago at York University when I worked there as a staff member, and he was a production manager there. And an interesting guy who'd been around and done a lot of work in theater and outside of theater. Mr. Alistair Hepburn on the AppLob Podcast.
The last time we were chatting, it was a discussion actually about the Richmond Hill Center.
That's right.
Yeah. Believe it or not, that's actually what it was. I had just done a show, Queen for a Day, starring the late Alan Thicke at the Richmond Hill Center. So.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that was one of the rare mounts we did at the Richmond Hill. Like it was actually like mounted and then went away after a while.
Yeah. I know we rehearsed there. We used the secondary space as a rehearsal space, did a complete fit up of the venue, teched it there, ran it. It was, you know, a new Canadian musical. It was interesting anyway.
So when was that? Was that after you left York or before you were at York?
No, that was after. After York, I went to Canadian Stage Company and became the director of production there. So, and I was at Canadian Stage for almost 5 years.
Yeah.
So after York, it was almost 5 years there. And then I went out on my own for a year as an independent, you know, gun for hire.
Yeah.
And that was, and then one of my last shows was Queen for a Day. I think my very last show was a Ross Petty pantomime, Snow White in 007. And then I went to work in an office job, went to work for Equity, and then ended up here at ACTRA.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's go further back because we met at York University over 10 years ago now. Well, yeah, it'd be in 2005, so 12 years ago. Yeah. I came in as a staff member, as a sound person, and we were a new department. And where I first met you is you were basically part of the theater department. But what was it? The performance part of it?
So I was the production manager of the Department of Theater. So it was the melding of the acting stream and the production stream. Mm-hmm. And we would actually mount the productions, right? We would use all of the students as the crew, as everybody up to the assistant production manager. So the technical directors, head carps, head of sound, head of lighting, all the tech positions were all done with students up to the assistant production managers, who were my guys, mm-hmm. and then me as the production manager. And then we would use the various staff. So you as the staff sound. We had Craig as our head carpenter. Amber tended to do lighting between her and Darren. They flip back and forth between the physical, you know, fit up of the stage and the lighting. Yeah, so it was kind of the shepherding the students through the process of how to get a show up onto its feet.
Yeah, and it must be rewarding because a lot of those people that were in your years are professional people now. And then obviously it's been a couple of years since I've been there. I haven't run into too many York alumni, but the people I do know, like the Andrew Smiths and the Joanna Hughes and the people, they're still working. Like,
yeah, so I mean, what York is really, really great at is producing designers and managers, right? Mm-hmm. But they all come to that world with a background in actually physically doing it, right? So it actually makes for, I think, a better designer, right? I mean, you get better designers who understand how a flat is built or what it actually takes to run cable to that unit that is sitting there and what wireless actually means, right? Mm-hmm. You really get to see, they don't just design purely for art. They also are able to design with some kind of real world knowledge behind it, which is really, really, you know, like Joanna Yu, great example. Brandon Kleiman, great example, right? Because they understand how things stand up. So it's not just, I'm going to draw a pretty picture for you. It's, I'm going to draw a pretty picture that will actually be able to be turned into something functional, mm-hmm. which is really, really great. And that's, you know, that's York's strength. There are other colleges and universities that are much, much better at producing, you know, pure technicians, you know, and that's, you know, an equally fantastic thing because you need that nice balance in the world, right?
Yeah, so. Yeah. My observation was a lot of people that came over from the performance side went over to the production side with the fact that, oh, wow, I actually now, if I can sustain a living in production based on and still enjoy my love of acting and or performing, but one would feed the other. And I thought that was a great blend of keeping how, you know, realistic expectations of what, you know, education can get you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, that educational system is really geared towards creating a really well-rounded individual, right? It's, we're going to give you a complete toolkit and you're going to decide how best to utilize the tools that you're given, right? So the performers they're forced to do crew. Right, like they're forced to do it because there's nothing better than having a performer who understands what their dresser is having to go through to, you know, to get that costume ready for them, right? Like it just makes for a more well-rounded individual in the arts,
and in the Canadian arts too, because it's much like the music industry where it's a very small industry and we all kind of know each other in a way. And we all sort of move about and see each other over the years. And we all at one point can help each other, you know. And that's the network that I think Canadians inherently are good at.
100%. This industry, you know, the live event industry in Canada is based on who you know, right? It really is. Because you are going to run into people that you know.
Yeah.
And you know, it pays to have good working relations with all of them because it's an incredibly small industry, you know. I mean, even though I've moved over into the film side of things now, it's still a ridiculously small industry here in Canada. Like it really is. I don't mean in terms of monetary value what it's worth, but purely in terms of just the number of people involved. It's a very familiar small group.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. And so when you, because what I heard, and this might be true, that when you started with York, you started with the first years and then kept along to see those people through school. Was that a thing that you sort of went at, you know, on your own when you started and finished? Was that always your intention, was to go for 5 years? And
well, I mean, it kind of it worked out nicely, right? It worked out very nicely because it did allow for a full cycle of seeing people all the way through. I can't admit to being nearly that clever, though, to having it been, you know, on purpose that way. But it really worked out great, and it actually, you know, it forged a lot of even better relationships because suddenly I'm now out in the world hiring people again, and I now know the exact product that I'm hiring, right? Because I've watched these guys grow into the humans that they now are after 4 full years and suddenly go, I know exactly what I'm getting here. And even if I can't hire you, I know someone that can, so let's figure that out, right?
Yeah. I think Darren worded it well, and I totally believe in it, where we'd see certain people that we would meet who'd be first and second years and go, I'd work for that person. I'd, you know what I mean? So put it in a realistic point, like I would definitely work with these or for these people, because there's a few people that come into that with the full intention. I mean, it's fun watching Drive, you know what I mean? Like how people are just sort of driven into, there's a form of ignorance in a way that says, I can do this. I can do anything I want. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm young. Mm-hmm. And that naivete takes you through into what becomes your career. And people I meet are the people that sort of hang on to that sort of like that thirst for change, you know, thirst for keeping things fresh.
Again, York is a very, very interesting case study because most of the people that are in the theater program are there because they think they want to be performers.
Yeah.
Right. That's why they're there. And, you know, halfway through their first year and, you know, full disclosure, I went to York as a student and that happened to me as well. I went to York to be an actor, and halfway through my first year, and I can see it happen, you know, in all of the first years that I saw go through, something just twigs in them and they go, I didn't know that this was a potential for how I could continue to work in theater without being a performer. I didn't know that there was this many options available to me, and oh my God, I really enjoy it. And oh my God, I'm really good at it. And wow, this may actually be a viable career path for me to still be an artist and work, right? Because, you know, the dog-eat-dog world of performance is tough, right? Yeah. And whereas, you know, the technical and design and management aspect, there are a lot more of those jobs. You know, for every one performer on stage, there's likely 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 people who've worked backstage. Mm-hmm. Right, but before the show even gets to a viewing audience. So it really, you know, it's a bit of a numbers game, but it's also a bit of an eye-opening experience as to what else is available. Because when you're in high school, you know, there's the guys on the AV club, and they do all of the tech for all of anything that happens, right? Any sort of concert, any sort of performance, and you don't consider all of the other aspects, right? The teachers do all the design work. I'm using air quotes there, you know, but suddenly, you as a student are now gifted this ability to design something and go, oh my God, this is for real, you know? So it's really, again, you know, I feel like I'm being a bit of a York, York a booster here, but that's really what they're great at, right? Mm-hmm. It's giving that well-rounded and thorough experience.
Yeah. I'm really glad you say things like this because my career at York ended sort of like, not so friendly. And when I hear people explain the good parts about it, I actually have a different look at it based on the fact that, first of all, one thing that becomes blatantly obvious to me when you say things is that it's the students first. The students are the ones who create. It's our job to watch it, but also foster, you know, and try not to stop people from making certain mistakes. But those mistakes sometimes need to happen. But what I like to hear was when you explain the stuff about how your career at York was, which is 5 years, was actually positive, you know, and that's good to know. Even though with all that's happening right now, I don't even think they're working yet. They're still on strike, right? Like,
there's still a bunch of them. Yeah, there's still a bunch of them still on strike. And that's been a bit of a plague, not just of York, but of, you know, the Canadian university system, but York in particular. That's tough on the students, and they're never going to, you know, those who are knee deep in that strike right now are going to come away from York with, you know, probably similar memories to yourself, right?
Yeah.
You know, and won't see it. I can't say that. As a student, I had a great experience, and then as an educator, I had a great experience, and it was always because it was the students first.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was strange. When you guys came on board, because the brand new department, brand new everything there, where there wasn't a lot of theory, it was all theory of how this was going to work, right? With no real practice, no real kind of gentle growing time. It was we're going to rip this Band-Aid off and we're going to throw these folks at a department that has been operating without them for years,
yeah,
right? You know, and we're going to try and squeeze them into a system that is not really designed for them to be squeezed into first and foremost. And they also have other responsibilities. And the theater department is a very, very needy thing, right? They do the bigger shows. They have the bigger student base. They want to try more difficult, challenging things, which is then all going to be a burden on the time of the staff who are there to support it. You know, and you just needed to look at the amount of overtime that you, Darren, and Amber were pulling,
yeah,
right, to see that, you know, it was a bit of a round peg square hole scenario. And, you know, I don't think in the time that I was there, I don't think we ever got it completely solved. You know, I think it was still an ongoing, you know, thing even after I left.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it was definitely a problem. The other department that had a big problem with it was the music department, because the music department could just sort of go into whatever that hall was over Winters, get the keys of the place, turn on the PA system, and do a show. And yeah. I don't know if you knew about this. I've said it a few times on the show, but the reason we became a department was because the music department, over the period of 20-something years, 30 years, had lost $1.8 million worth of equipment. They're gone. People walked away with microphones and guitar amps. There was no key holders, nobody to hold the keys.
Yeah.
And my observation was there was a few people that hated us as we came into the music department, particularly me, myself, that we were the people that were like stopping them, you know, when we were the ones obviously had a vested interest to make life better, not just for ourselves, but for everybody. But we had the people that were the full-on haters and the people that were coming around. And there'd be certain faculty members that every year would come in. They would come in with a new understanding of, oh, okay, this is why you're here.
Yeah. I mean, because the Department of Theater had a couple of staff that were kind of doing those jobs, right? And then in sort of the...
Left a little unceremoniously too, right?
Yes, absolutely. And the resizing, let's call it the resizing of or reallocation of funds, was an attempt by the dean at that point to make what he saw was working in the theater department, because those staff worked, and they worked really, really well in the theater department, was a chance to make that model work for all of the fine arts colleges, right? So the film department to a lesser degree, but the music department and the dance department specifically, right?
Yeah.
Because they were the poor orphan without any sort of technical guru or leadership available to them. And it just, I think it may have grown too quick, you know, too big, too fast, right? Because all the right people were hired and all the right people were actually in charge, you know, like my predecessor, you know, Cameron Moore, who went over to run that department, was absolutely the right guy to do it.
Yeah.
Right. But again, you know, too big, too fast. So it was tough. Like it was growing pains. That's what it was.
Yeah.
But it was the continuation of them trying to throw the same
model,
you know, model at it, at the problem year after year without any sort of alteration or change to it. And,
yeah,
you know, a bit of the definition of insanity, right? You know, repeat the same process and expect a different result.
Yeah.
And that result never came. You know, and they ended up losing some pretty crackerjack staff because of it, right? Yeah.
Well, the rub is that we're trying to teach you world, like, knowledge, like real-world knowledge within an institution. So the rub is where you're trying to teach people what the pragmatic way to get from A to B, and say the quickest way to do this is to do it this way. And the process is as important. So if you take a longer process to get to the same objective, that is what university is.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? That makes sense, right? You have to go through all these like equations. You can't just take your calculator out and give the answer to the equation. You have to actually go through the process, the why, you know, this is a problem and a solution. So
it was always, one of the things that we always did, and I was lucky to have a great, a great friend as my carpenter in Craig. And Craig and I used to talk about that it was always the journey, not the destination. Mm-hmm. And you know what? If the flat wasn't quite square, that's okay, because we're going to learn from that as well. You know, because now we got to figure out, well, now how do we put two non-square flats together?
Yeah.
Because you've accepted these flats upon delivery, and now you have to build a set that oh, look at that. It doesn't actually fit together the way you thought it did. Mm-hmm. All right, so now let's figure out this journey as well. So it was, that's what we did, right? It was constantly the putting the journey in front of the students. And you know what? If the destination looks great and sounds great and lights up great and happens, fantastic. Mm-hmm. But all of the stuff along the way is actually equally as important, because that's the stuff you're going to remember the next time you have to do this, about how you figured this out. And you know, that's when you start arming yourself with all the shortcuts and all the knowledge tricks and stuff like that.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. So after you left York, you went to Mirvish, or what'd you do?
No.
Were you from Mirvish to?
The long and sordid tale of Alistair. Here, I'll give you the quick CV. So graduated in 95 from York, went off immediately actually to Canadian Stage, to the Dream in High Park. So as a, you know, grunt PA sound guy, if you can believe it, I was the sound guy at the Dream in High Park. You know, that's about as close to it as I got to a soundboard ever again. And then I became the PA for a season, then the ATD at Canadian Stage, and then punted myself over to Young People's Theatre as the TD for a couple seasons, went off to the Blythe Festival as the technical director, came back from Blythe, sadly out of work, and I just happened to throw a resume at Mirvish Productions. I didn't know anybody there. I did know someone there. And she said, well, you know, I know they're looking, so why don't you, they haven't posted. So I sent in a resume. They called me in for an interview the following week and got hired the next day. And ended up as the associate production manager at Mirvish for a good few seasons. Did all the Lion Kings and the Mamma Mias and the producers and the Hairsprays, which was that some of the best, you know, you want to talk about learning on the job. That was that was learning on the job experience, that one, you know, to go from the Young People's Theater, $20,000 to put on a show, to the multi-million dollars to put on a show was pretty spectacular. Then I went and worked on a movie, and then I went and worked at the Royal Ontario Museum as their production manager for all their live events, back to Mirvish.
When were you at Royal Ontario Museum? When were you there at the ROM?
What year was that? That would have been either 99 or 2000, maybe 2000. 2000, I think it was.
Yeah, because I did a few. I worked for, because I guess the U of T somehow dealt with the audio part somehow. It was like, I dealt with people across the road from the ROM who was they'd hire me to go do this little theater down in the basement of the ROM.
Yeah, the Egyptian theater.
It's so cool. You have to climb up a ladder to get to the booth and
a little perch. Yeah. And they did everything in there. They did theater productions, they did movie screenings, they did concerts, they did guest lecture talks. It was a fascinating time. And then they also, every Friday night in the main gallery, would turn it into an event space, right? And Friday nights at the ROM, when they started attracting singles nights, and you know, and they had DJs, and
they still do stuff like that, right?
Yeah. It's a fantastic experience, right? Mm-hmm. To just kind of be amongst all of the cool artifacts and having a mojito, right? Like it's kind of a nice it's a nice little first world experience. And then I ran back to Mirvish. Oh God, where did I go then? I went to the Canadian Opera Company. Then I went to a props fabrication house called Paragon, and they had the clients. They were the contractors who built all of the puppets for Lion King, all of the sets and props for Mamma Mia, and then they took on Lord of the Rings the musical.
Oh, I've heard so many great stories of that place.
So I was the kind of the lead hand on Lord of the Rings the musical, and basically I think I spent something like $1 million on R&D of various props in my time there, and then went and saw the musical and was like, what the hell happened? Oh my God.
I guess we were speaking, was it last year during TIFF, where I was at Princess of Wales because my job was to make three PA companies all speak the same technical language for one Lady Gaga song. So I was like looking up and I like knew you'd worked here, and I was taking pictures and I thought, hey, this, maybe you're still here. Hang out, you know? And there was a few people that had worked on those shows that told me stories about the revolving, that revolving stage, and how they went to England and they had it built and then they moved it and it just didn't work. And there
it was it was one of those marvelously fantastical, terrible experiences to work on, because all the players were the right players and it should have been brilliant. Like, it literally, it should have been brilliant, right? You know, epic tale, fantastical music, brilliant cast, some really, really exciting design elements. Like, the designer was just insanely genius, like just a genius. And some of the stuff that they were producing, like the Dark Riders and stuff, you know, using scaffolding stilts, like the drywall stilts.
Yeah.
So using the drywall stilts to just because the movement that you could do on them, and then it just didn't come together. It just couldn't jive. It just couldn't work. So
that was the story of too much technology, and
I think so. I think.
Getting to the story.
What was the Julie the Spider-Man turn off the dark or something like that? I think it suffered from very similar, you know, on paper was very exciting, and then when all that tech came together, it just overshadowed the actual performance. Like, it just, you know, it killed the performance.
Would you say it's maybe a little ahead of its time based on the fact that people were trying to put movies into theater, like making a movie out of a theater production?
Yeah, I think so. Because, I mean, you know, if you look now, like, all of the big Broadway musicals, except for, like, Hamilton, were movies, right?
Yeah.
You know, Mean Girls, Clueless, right? Like, they were hilarious movies, and now they're really, you know, Bring It On. Like, they're all touring stage shows now.
Yeah.
Matilda, there are the Wickeds of the world, but a lot of them are movies. Just ahead of the curve, I think.
Yeah, is it trying like now to get a different audience in to watch or to absorb it or to consume it, or is like, because I know theater, and obviously theater, musical theater in general, is a taste. It's acquired taste. People love it. Mm-hmm. It's very polarizing when people are like, say, well, you know, I could do that. And when they start putting musicals into movies, I started watching, like, you know, you watch Frozen or something, and you go, well, my son and I watched it for the first time, and I'm like, there's a lot of singing in this. And I didn't realize it wasn't a freaking musical. You know what I mean? Like,
And then
my daughter's like sitting there transfixed on the movie, like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen on film. But trying to reverse engineer it back to the stage, is it trying to garner a new audience, and where purists kind of go, meh, maybe not?
Well, I mean, I think so, but I think it's also, it's a bit of the Disney-fying of the stage, right? Disney did a very, very smart thing in all of their musicals. At one point or another, have been a 20-minute show at one of their theme parks, right? They boil it down to its essentials, and they turn it into a show at their theme park, right? You know, the Finding Nemo live stage show, Frozen has a live stage show. The Lion King has a different take on The Lion King as a stage show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they were all like 20 minutes, half an hour long, and that's it, right? Like, it's basically bite-sized chunks.
Yeah.
And we're met with such, you know, people would go back and back and back that they decided to take the chance, you know, and they turned Aladdin into a stage show. And, you know, Mary Poppins into a stage show, and, you know, Frozen is a stage show. But the technology is now available for all of that stuff, right?
Yeah.
To make it, you know, like the magic carpet can actually fly, and, you know, and Mary Poppins can, you know, come in on her umbrella, and Bert can dance upside down across the proscenium, you know, and Elsa can wave a hand and icicles will appear, mm-hmm. right? Projections are a marvelous, marvelous thing, right? With what you can do now.
Definitely. Yeah.
So, you know, so I think the technology is now there that allows this stuff to happen that it would never have allowed for. And it can be a fantastical experience that, you know, that kids can go to. And I think that's good, right? I think opening up the door to children to enjoy and take in live entertainment is a good thing. Right. But it also teaches them, you know, how to behave in public, which is a pretty amazing thing too, right? You know,
yeah.
like,
never
like
thought of that.
You know, it's not really a lesson that you generally get while sitting at home watching Frozen on repeat.
Totally.
We're gonna quietly enjoy this, and there will be moments where we can cheer really loud, but you need to actually sit and listen to them because they can hear you too. Right. And that's a really interesting experience to take a first time theater goer too, is for them to see live interaction and you know what that respect and etiquette looks like.
Yeah.
And
I mean, as you get older too, it's fun to watch the nuances of something you might know already, or say if you've seen Phantom 8 times, is to say, like, you know, oh, that's a neat little part, though, or the person, you can tell where they've forgotten their lines a little bit, or there's spit coming out their mouth, or there's something that's just like, that sort of takes you a little bit away from it, because you still have to realize, well, I'm really into the story, but wait a minute, these are people on stage, they're performing in front of me.
Oh, absolutely. You know, as I said, I was as the associate production manager on Lion King and Mamma Mia, so I've probably seen each of those between 85 and 100 times, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So then it became the interesting thing was watching beyond the show, right? And picking up on all those little subtle things that performers get to do on a nightly basis to keep the show fresh for themselves too, that the audience may never pick up on.
That's true.
Right? Because they're only seeing it the one time.
Yeah.
Again, that's the great part. I just took my family we just went and saw Wicked at the Ed Mervish Theater a couple weeks back. And at intermission, they replaced the lead.
Oh, right? Wow.
So we got two Elphabas in one show. So we got to see Elphaba 1, and then we got to see the standby Elphaba in Act 2. And it was so amazing to see two completely different people bring their take on the character to the stage. Like, it kind of enhanced the experience for us, because it was also a bit of a, oh, this is really cool. You don't get to see this very often, right?
Yeah.
You don't get to see someone take over a role halfway through the show.
Yeah.
It didn't detract from it. It probably made the show that much better for us, right?
That's amazing. Just, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you work with Rent? Did Rent came through?
I just missed Rent. Rent had just left Mervish when I started there, because I started there in 99, and I think Rent was there in like 98. 97, 90. Yeah.
Because
I just missed it.
Because Chad Richardson, the lead in Rent?
One of them, yeah.
He was recording in my recording studio in like the late 90s, and he was also the lead in Rent.
Yeah.
And I remember there's one time where he calls in and says, "I'm not making it in, so get my replacement to do it." You know, to do it.
Yeah, the understudy.
So the understudy. So they go, "But you have a whole busload of fans, like
who've come in just to see you."
And he felt so horrible, because like, it's too late now, right? It's 7:30, shows at 8 kind of thing. He called it in at like, and they're like, "Oh, by the way, there's a whole busload of kids here to meet you and see your show." And he's like, "Oh God, oh boy."
did he at least go down to see them at stage door?
No,
or something?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
But you know what? If we can create kind of like a bit of a rock star vibe out of theater folk, I'm all for it, right? The number of people that hang out after Come From Away at the stage door to meet the cast of Come From Away, mm-hmm. I love that.
Yeah.
Like that was not a thing during, you know, there were the odd folks during Lion King and Mamma Mia and stuff like that, but it's actually become a thing now. And I think a lot of that has to do with social media too, right? Because you want to post the picture of yourself with the person that you just saw on stage. And, you know, and for all of its negatives, I think social media has been a huge, huge boom for the live entertainment industry,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It really, really has. You know, and, you know, you're seeing or hearing podcasts of plays, and, you know, Stratford Festival is filming all of their Shakespeares now and putting them into theaters and then putting them on CBC, and then will, you know, likely, I hope, release some sort of box set, some anthology set of, you know, all of the Shakespeares.
Mm-hmm.
A great new take on English language Shakespeare. Like, I think there's digital media is super, super helpful for that live entertainment industry.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk now about putting plays, live streaming them into cinemas where you can, you know, live theater can be now streamed in high definition in IMAX to anybody all over North America. And there's a lot of, and there's always a polarizing conversation about that, because a lot of people are like, I would rather be there at the show than see the live blah, 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 blah. And then there's even a further conversation about virtual reality, because they have augmented reality and virtual reality. And one day you'll be able to buy a virtual ticket, sit in your seat, and look to your right and see that guy across the who's across the country as your buddy, who's sitting there beside you watching the same performance in a virtual reality. We're not that far away. I mean, it's science fiction, but we're not that far away.
I don't think so.
What is your feelings, like your gut reaction to live theater that's recreated versus the actual live? I mean, obviously the actual is great, but we're in a world of compromise now.
Absolutely. Given any day of the week, I'd rather see it live and in person, right? Because it really is it's the original 4D, right? It's, you know, because you're, it's not just the sight and the sound of it. It's, you know, it's the people behind you. It's the old lady two seats over who's unwrapping her, you know, crinkly candies and stuff that all make that experience. And, you know, and VR may take you into that world. But that being said, you know, if you just think of it purely from the financial side of things, if you're doing a production that's in a 500 seat theater and you can stream it, and instead of 500 people watching it, 5,000 people are watching it, you know, like, how does that not benefit you? Because, you know, there will always be the theater purists. There's always going to be the theater purists that want to be there to experience it, right? But if you can then attract someone in Boise, Idaho, who, you know, is not going to make a flight to Toronto just to see this production, but they will spend $20 to live stream it, you know, or go to an IMAX or, you know, watch it. Dear Lord, why would you not get behind that? It's just, you know, I think introducing people to art is really, that's important for me, right? That's really what is the crucial aspect here, not necessarily how they consume it, you know? I think it pains me as well when I know that people are pouring millions of dollars into production values of like a TV show, right? Yeah. And then I watch it on my iPhone. Right, you know, like they've designed something that was meant to be immersive on a, you know, let's, you know, 60-inch 4K screen at home even, and here I am watching it on my iPhone 8, right? And, you know, it's like, oh no, I feel terrible, but this is how I choose to consume my media. So it's one of those, you know, I think theater practitioners need to be cognizant of how their audience want to consume media. Right. Yeah. You know, and, you know, there's the running gag about, you know, well, theater audiences are dying because all of the blue hair is starting to fade.
They're literally dying. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and, but here's an opportunity to embrace people who, you know, and again, maybe they don't have the $80 to buy the ticket to go see it live, but they probably have the 20.
They got their parking, and then they got their dinner, and then they got their gas and, you know, and all that sort of good stuff. You could spend $300 for two people to go see a Mervis production.
Yeah.
Easy.
No, absolutely easy. And, you know, and even if it's not live streamed, even if it is, you know, the video on demand type stuff, that way they get to choose when they consume it, so that they're, you know, because not everybody can work around the schedule of an 8 o'clock curtain, right? Mm-hmm. It's not possible for a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
You know, so it's one of those, in this society, in this day and age, people want to consume media when they choose to consume it. Yeah. And, you know, so maybe it's important for theater to understand time shifting, right? And, you know, because they don't, theaters don't time shift. Theaters, it starts at 8 and it will be done at 10 or 10:30. That's it. Mm-hmm. So maybe there needs to be some thought of, well, yeah, but if we can make this accessible to someone at 10 o'clock at night or at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, maybe we're going to increase. Now, you know, the budgets, again, like that's, you know, that's a different conversation, but I think there needs to be some sort of give and take, you know, produce a couple a year that you can stream and then, you know, hook people and get them into the, you know, to experience it in actual living 3D, right? Like,
Yeah, I was thinking when you're saying that you somehow need to say, here's a convenient way for you to consume this, but it's not like the real thing. But, you know, eventually, 100 years from now, you won't be able to dissociate between what's real and what's not real, because everything will be so far advanced based on what has happened over the past 30 years, you know, with technology. So one might be able to say that in 30 or 40 years from now, I'll be able to sit in this room with you and we'll be able to have a real conversation like I was down at your office, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where this will be the way we do things now. And for that, that to me is that you've tipped it over the edge of, to me, now you're actually in full virtual reality. But there still needs to be that message, like, the best way to consume a baseball game is being at the baseball game. You know what I mean? You can watch it on TV and have someone narrate to you how cool this game is. Or you can go there and be with a bunch of other people around you and go, oh, this is great. We're all here together to cheer for this team or something, you know? And and that's the experience. There was
a theater company? No, ballet company. A ballet company a couple of years ago did a live stream, which was then available on a recording, and I have a need to think of what it was called. It was called the Monster Machine, I think it was. But what it allowed you to do was they had a multiple camera setup, right? They were all static cameras, but there was something like 12 cameras, right? One of them was over the stage manager's shoulder. One of them was, you know, looking at the conductor. One of them was, you know, front of house camera. One of them was an overtop camera. And you, as the consumer,
could real-time choose?
Real-time choose what camera you watch from, right? So, you know, and so you could be in the wings seeing who was about to come on and then flip to the front camera to see them come on and then flip to the overhead camera to see them do the pirouette, you know, multiple times, you know, and it was just like this really cool experiment in, you know, when you say, you know, you it's better to watch a ball game live. It's better to watch a ball game live because you get to decide where you want to look.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not a fixed focal point. It's not a fixed view of, well, this is the only thing that I'm allowed to look at, and I can't see what's happening in the outfield with that guy at the moment, you know, who's trying to stretch out his quad, and then when he tries to run for the ball, you wonder, why is he limping? Mm-hmm. You know, because being there live, you've seen it happen. So this, to me, was like a very exciting, like, oh, wow, okay, these folks are onto something here, right? Yeah. You know?
Definitely, most definitely. It's I was trying to figure out the same idea with live music too, because with bands that play live music, it's a whole, especially bands that are developed, that there's a revenue stream involved of the live show. So if you were to try to possibly make a sale based on the live show, is to try to sell the show to the audience that was there. And a lot of bands come back to me and go, you know, we don't want to be sound like we want with all the mistakes we make. And I go, but you don't understand. That's the best part. Like, your 500 fans will want to hear you mess up a word. That's exciting. That means you're human. Like,
wasn't that like the holy grail of the bootleg tapes? Was all of the Grateful Dead bootlegs that existed?
Yeah.
Of, you know, people recording concerts that weren't actually recorded.
Yeah.
And like that became the collector's item. That became the most sought after thing. Was all those bootlegs, right?
Yeah.
I mean, God, I would love it. I would love it if I could, you know, be listening to a band that I love and be able to isolate the bass track.
Totally.
You know, just like this song I love so much, I want to listen to it this time, but I really would like to isolate the bass track. Mm-hmm. Like, that would be so sweet.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah. And it's available. It's possible. It's what the people that create the art are having the difficult, you know what I mean? To go, wait a minute, we have to have some quality control here, you know? You know, I work with the band Lowest of the Low, and I keep saying, listen, man, you guys have fans. They love you. They want to hear everything you do always. Yeah, there you go.
Big. Sorry, I'm raising my hand here.
Yeah.
Big.
So if you were to come to a concert and someone said, purchase this show, I am sure that 30-40% of the people in that audience will buy that show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a fearful thing as Lowest of the Low, because you think, oh, I might have screwed up that one song. But that's, like I said, explained before, that's the joy of it. That's the magic, because, you know, the speaking in between, mentioning my town and all these things, these are all great things. And a lot of bands kind of, they do the same set. So a band like Lowest of Low have hundreds of songs. They can do a different set every show for a year and still not play the same set two times in a row.
Yeah.
So that, to me, is like, we're not there yet. You know what I mean? I'm still working on him. So there might be.
Well, tell Ron that he needs to figure this out. Because, I mean, you know, the banter between him and Steven during live shows was like, that was always the highlight.
Yeah. The trouble is, Steven's not in the band anymore.
Yeah, I know. So he just needs to figure out some other banter, right? Yeah. Somebody else to pick on.
He would say the funniest things too, because every show I've worked, I've done like five or six shows with Lois Lowe over the past year, and the funniest thing he mentions is where they ate. You go, we went to this place and ate, and everybody's like, I was there too. Yeah. And the funniest thing, you know, you said, in 3 hours, you've eaten twice, you know, like, so that's just stuff you can't, he goes, your town is delicious. I mean, like, you can't, I wish someone could hear that, because it was such perfect timing. But that, to me, wasn't had anything to do with playing the music. It was just the funniest thing. There's a band called NoFX. I don't know if you know. They're a punk rock band from San Francisco. I told their record label that they should just put a record of Fat Mike speaking in between songs, because and call it slander, because he says some of the stupidest things that get him in a lot of trouble. I don't know if you've heard, there was some things.
I've heard a couple of them.
But I mean, that's the experience of live. I mean, you get to see it live, and you see it with a bunch of other people around you, and it does drive me nuts when everybody's got their phone up trying to capture that, because you can't. Mm-hmm. You cannot capture it with your phone. As exciting as you think it is. Like, another example is if you go to this beautiful mountain range and you pull out your iPhone and you take a picture of it, the view you see is never the one that gets put into the onto the screen that you try to show people. Like, you know, so being there, okay, maybe it's a good thing to be, but the next best thing is having someone present it to you, you know?
Yeah, well, and present it properly.
Exactly.
Right? And then to switch hats for a moment, you know, when I think of as, you know, with a performer hat on, I would be so fearful of giving up my intellectual property, right? Yeah. To that level, right? Yeah. To give up access and control of my likeness, my voice, my mistake, my whatever, that would have to be a pretty scary thing too, right? Part of the joy of live music is it happens and it's gone, right? And the only place that it's captured is in your brain, and you know, and it only gets better the farther away you get from it, because your brain
remembers
all these,
romantically,
absolutely, did they make a mistake in that song? I don't remember. All I can remember is how good it was. And, like, there's something kind of really romantic about that as well. But, there's making art for making art. And then there's making art because you also want to make a living, right? And because, you need to pay your rent, and you need to feed your family, and, you need to buy a new guitar, or you want to buy a new guitar. Like, it's, you have to kind of weigh all of those possibilities. Right?
Definitely. I was thinking of one of my favorite concerts of all time. I saw 1987, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And it was at Kingswood Music Theater, and it was Crowded House, the first time they played a big show in the Toronto area, because they had played little tiny places. And then Kingswood Music Theater sold out. I was at the very back on the grass, and I went there. My son was playing like one of these band competition things. So I went to the very back, and I sat down, and I witnessed through my mind's eye what I had seen. And it's obviously the same location. You're in the same spot. Only there was like a little kid band playing like, like kind of crazy music. But that's the part. If someone said to me, oh, buy this concert, someone said $4,000. Okay, I'll buy it. I'll buy it right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I met the guy who was their front of house guy during Lord of the Dance at the amphitheater, Molson Amphitheater. And he goes, I have board tapes. I go, do you have board tapes from July 1987? He goes, yes, I do. I go, my God. And this is sort of like in the 98, 99. I said, give me your whatever. Give me your phone number. He goes, I'm not giving you a phone number. And I'm like, well, I just need this concert so bad. I want to hear it, you know. And I've looked for years to try and find a board version, a board copy, because they recorded every single show.
Oh, amazing.
Every show.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. No, I had a great couple of summers at the Kingswood Music Theater. I worked there as one of the techs, so I got to see a lot of fantastic.
What years were you there? Were you in July 1987?
I was not, sadly. No. I was there the summer of 92, summer of 93.
Okay.
I got to see Sting, and stand beside Sting, and I got to play basketball with Ringo Starr and Nils Lofgren, backstage, and I got to watch one of the Cranberries knock himself out walking into a piece of scaffolding that was hanging lower than he thought it was, right? like all those great kind of things.
That's a famous story, actually. That's a story that I've heard before.
Cranberry story. It was pretty remarkable. The Cranberries opened for Sade on that fateful night, and Sade had the entire set ringed in white scrim, and it was weighted at the bottom with, it was stretched between truss top and bottom. And the truss was about probably like, you know, the bottom of the truss was probably at about 5'8". So you had to duck to get under it. And this guy didn't, he missed it completely. Yeah. Knocked himself out cold.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Hit the ground.
The second concert I ever saw was there at Kingswood Music Theater in 1984, because it was Huey Lewis in the News, and it was during the sports tour.
Yeah.
And my buddy and I bought tickets at Scarborough Town Center, and my parents are like, where's the concert? I'm like, it's a Canada's Wonderland. I'm like, well, how are you going to get there? I'm like, I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet. We'll get there. We'll take a bus. You're 14. You can't take a bus from, you know what I mean? It's like, sure, we can make it. So my buddy Andrew Rothy and I went and saw Huey Lewis in the News when I was 14 years old. I had floors, like good seats and everything. And it was one of the first real like a rock and roll experiences, because before that, I'd been too far away to actually get like the full, you know, sound of what a PA system could sound like. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I saw that show there. And phenomenal. What a great place. It's too bad they don't do real shows there anymore. I don't know what happened and why.
Yeah. I think the Molson Amphitheater happened, right? I think that's, you know, because replacement. So I also worked the last summer of the Forum, right? The last summer of the revolving stage of the Forum. And when that came down and then you saw the plans for what was going up in its place, you were like, yep, that's the death knell for Kingswood right there. Because, slightly bigger venue, easier to get to, right down on the water, you know, closer to Buffalo, so that, you know, for trucks coming across the border, super easy.
Except for the bridge getting across into the loading area.
That's right.
Which buses would literally get hung up on. It was too...
I think that's what did it in. Because it was never the quality of crew up there. It was never the venue, you know, it was a great place to see music, you know, sit up on the lawns. Like,
totally.
You know.
Yeah, that's where I saw Credit House, up in the very back. I said, we don't need to get up there. It's going to be fine. And I must admit, once it started, I'm like, God, I wish I was down there now. You know?
Yeah. No, it's, I think I remember those lawns. There was a massive, massive thunderstorm during Kim Mitchell, and the lawns turned into a sod chucking.
Yeah.
Like people were ripping up chunks of the sod and throwing it, and it just became this giant mud pit. It's crazy. Crazy, crazy. But no, I saw so many good, so many good bands.
Yeah. The Forum, I saw the Village People at the Forum. And I wasn't even that young. I was like, how old was I? 19? Was 18? Would have been 89. No, actually, probably 1990-ish. Mm-hmm. It was towards the end of the Forum. And at the same time, at the Senior Grandstand, Slayer was playing. So when the Village People came out, Slayer was just going on. So there was a bunch of people still. So can you imagine this, the sort of the juxtaposition of demographics walking up to the GO station? It was very funny to watch, because a lot of the Slayer fans are inherently a little bit ignorant when it comes to, you know what I mean, like acceptance.
Yeah.
And the Village People was the most fun show I've ever like been to in a very long time. I still remember it. And how much fun it was, because they call themselves the old kids on the block, you know, because I guess the new kids on the block had just sort of like... were like just becoming something at the time. And my God, what a great show. And I know a guy who used to work, you know, where it would turn, and the snake would get coiled around.
I would do that.
You did that.
I would page the cable out. Yeah, I did that. Absolutely.
You did that. There was another guy, Brillo, that did it. Do you know a guy named Brillo? He was a little guy. He's older than us, but he used to do it too. He told me the story about it, because you'd have to, and he would get loaded down there. Like he would just drink tons of alcohol because he was a drunk. And just do it, because you'd page it all the way down that long hallway, and then it would then get taken back up and then take it away. Yeah, that was your gig. No, oh my God!
I that's where I started, and then I graduated to a variety of things, the follow spots, and I got put beside the guy at the monitor desk a lot for some reason. I think it was to keep him awake. I'm pretty sure, or not drinking or something like that. No, we did. I think my favorite concert there was probably Tom Jones. That was probably my favorite concert. But the night that Pink Floyd were playing at Exhibition Stadium, it was the Gypsy Kings playing at the Molson Amphitheater. And, you know, so they started into Bombaleo just as these giant inflatable pigs rose above Exhibition Stadium, green lasers, and then the, you know, the cash register for money. Money started, right? And it was just like, this is the strangest experience I have ever gone through.
Yeah. Actually, the most interesting, because I worked a lot of local crew shows at the amphitheater, the most interesting show was the most simplest, and it was the Bob Dylan show, where all he had was white lights that were all project, or like shadow play on these on a screen behind them. So there's like a big shadow of the band at different times and different positions. I'm like, that's the most exciting show I've ever seen. Like, it's neat because it's just shadow play. The whole thing is just very simple. There's no color in any, and they were ground supported lights. They didn't have a truss.
Fantastic.
Didn't even have a truss. It was brilliant. Fastest
load in and take out ever.
Yeah, totally, right? Yeah. Well, yeah,
I miss those live music days.
Yeah. I don't miss sweating my sack off at the amphitheater. I don't miss that. I do not miss that. I did a few, like, did a show at Key to Bala a couple of weeks ago, and it's hot as sin up there. And now my life is sort of like I'm a facilitator. I'm an administrator. So my life is now proactively trying to stop people from making mistakes, you know, and that's the exciting part of getting older. And I always saw guys that were like in their 60s and 50s and even 40s that were at the amphitheater doing a loadout. And I go, oh, God, I don't think I could do that. I don't think I could, you know, and I, you know, all the power to people that do that stuff. But for me personally, I don't think my body could put up with that.
No, and that was, I mean, my goal was, I have some very incredibly dear friends who are stagehands, and, you know, my hat goes off to them, the work that they do, right? And just the sheer physical things that they go through. But that was never what I wanted to do. I loved doing it when I was doing it, but it was a young man's game for me at that point. And I knew that it was a young man's game, and didn't want to do that as I got older, and, you know, kind of wormed my way into the management aspect of things instead.
Yeah, we all have our direction, right? We all have our goals, and we end up getting there at times, you know, that, you know, my thing was I applied for the TD position I'm at 12 years ago, but before the building had even opened. I had an interview and everything, but I didn't get the job. So, and I always find it somewhat validating that it's like, it took 12 years, but I'm here. I got it, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. But, you know, the things happen at the right time, right?
Totally. Like
they happen at the right time for you. Because if you had got that position 12 years ago, think of all the experiences that you would have missed out on that can now feed into you being an even better TD than you would have been then, right?
Yeah, you raise a very good point. That's totally true. Yeah. I really enjoyed this. I it's good to get caught up, and it's good to sort of get your perspective on theater. And, you know, like, even just talking about York, like I said, I was negative. My whole thing about York is just inherently negative. It's good to hear someone sort of take a side, you know, and that's very cool, man. I appreciate you doing the show, and you know, like, if you ever want to do it again, you got something to talk about, I'm here.
Excellent. This has been great. Thank you.
And that was Mr. Alistair Hepburn, a swell fella and a good soul and a good guy. And yeah, it was fun to talk. I haven't talked to him in a while. It's been a very long time. Thanks for doing the show, Alistair. Also, thanks to all you folks for going to Amazon shopping there. It's very helpful. I really appreciate you doing that. Oh, my daughter just Snapchatted me. That's another thing I don't understand, everybody. Snapchat. I don't get it. I don't understand. I don't know how it works. I thought it was the app you showed your wiener on, but it turns out my daughter's on it. I don't know what that means. It means that Snapchat is not an app you show your wiener on. Anyways, thanks for doing the show, Alistair. Like I said before, I think you two can help the show out. Become a patron. Go to patreon.com/apologpod. Go to patreon.com/apolog. I'm completely butchering this outro. Next week, I have... I have Mr. Justin Small. He's coming back. He's back, baby. Oh, it's going to be a good time. Thanks for listening to the show every week, everybody. It was nice to see you all. And we'll see you again next week. Have a great day.